Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. Saudi Arabia and its allies sever ties with Iran.
The cutting off of diplomatic ties with Iran is in a reaction to Iran's aggressive policies over the years and in particular over the past few months.
That's Saudi Foreign Minister Adel El Jubar explaining why the Saudis have cut off relations with Iran, with the severing of ties that are more than just diplomatic.
We decided to cut off all diplomatic relations with Iran. We will also be cutting off all air traffic to and from Iran. We will be cutting off all commercial relations with Iran, and we will have a travel ban against people traveling to Iran.
Saudi Arabia's allies curbed their diplomatic links with Iran on Monday after protesters stormed the country's embassy in Tehran. Bahrain and Sudan cut their diplomatic ties, while the United Arab Emirates downgraded its relations with Iran. A rapidly worsening diplomatic crisis erupted Saturday shortly after Saudi officials announced the execution of Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr. 46 others were also executed, triggering international outrage and warnings of grave repercussions for the Saudi royal family. An alliance of more than a dozen militant groups called the United Jihad Council, based in Pakistani Kashmir, has claimed responsibility for an attack by heavily armed gunmen on a strategic Indian airbase about 50 kilometers from the border with Pakistan. Operations continued for a third day to secure the airbase in the northern Punjab state, which was infiltrated by heavily armed gunmen on Saturday. Five gunmen have been killed and seven security personnel have died in the attack. The United Jihad Council, which is fighting to end Indian rule in Kashmir, said it wanted to show India that no military installation was out of the reach of the militants, and India should allow Kashmiris to decide their own political future. The claim of responsibility came from a news-based agency within Pakistan. This is VOA News. The U.S. government has shut down a drone base in southern Ethiopia that was part of the U.S. anti-terrorism effort in the region. The U.S. Embassy in Addis Ababa told VOA on Monday that U.S. military personnel are no longer in Arbaminj. That's the town where the base was located. The U.S. base opened in 2011 and was used to launch drones over Somalia, home to the Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab. A Sudan opposition leader said her party will honor an African Union invitation to hold talks in Ethiopia with Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir's government for a national dialogue intended to resolve the country's problems. The dialogue, launched last year by President Bashir, is currently being held in Sudan. Islamic State militants attacked Iraqi troops and allied tribal fighters outside the western town of Haditha on Monday, killing at least 11 and wounding dozens, according to officials. The Associated Press reported that 30 troops were wounded in the attacks, which included a suicide car bombing and roadside bombs. The attack comes a week after Iraqi troops, backed by U.S.-led airstrikes and Sunni tribesmen, pushed ISIS out of central Ramadi, the capital of Anbar province. The U.S. and its allies conducted 25 strikes against Islamic State militants in Iraq yesterday. The British Foreign Office says it's examining a video circulated Sunday purporting to show an Islamic State execution of five men it said were spying for Britain in Syria. The 10-minute film depicted the man allegedly confessing to espionage. One of the gunmen said the execution was a message to David Cameron. He, of course, is the Prime Minister of Britain, who has ramped up attacks on Islamic State insurgents in Iraq and Syria. This is Prime Minister Cameron responding.
Well, look, they hate us not for what we do, but for what we are. The fact that we are a successful, tolerant, democratic, multi-faith, multi-ethnic nation. They hate that, and that's why they want to take us on, and that's why they do what they do. But I know that Britain will never be cowed by this sort of terrorism. Our values are so much stronger than theirs.
On the video, the purported spies were each shot in the head. President Obama is meeting today with his top law enforcement officials ahead of his expected announcement of executive orders tightening federal gun control regulations. By working through executive orders, the president believes he does not need the backing of Congress, which is led by members of the Republican Party, who overwhelmingly oppose restrictions on gun ownership, much like as many other people in the country. The president's focus on gun violence, however, comes after a series of deadly mass shootings across the United States. And U.S. stock prices fell sharply in Monday's early trading following a sell-off in China, a slump in Europe, and rising tensions in the Middle East. Joe Palca, reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yais Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
There are two different kind of flows, actually, because in Greece you have seen the arrivals of so many people fleeing from Syria. I think that a large majority of people arriving in Greece from Turkey, which is a country of transit, is Syrian, and then there are Afghans and Iraqis and Pakistanis, but mainly Syrians and Afghans. In Greece we are seeing a refugee crisis because these are people who are fleeing a war. So as long as the war will not end and the situation in Syria will be so difficult, of course this flow will not end.
That's Flavio Di Giacomo, Italy's spokesperson for the International Organization for Migration. We'll have full details on the story coming up.
Also in the news, the U.S. State Department expresses deep disappointment that Rwandan President Paul Kagame has chosen to run for a third term in office. And Filippo Grandi has begun his five-year term as the new U.N. Refugee Agency chief.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Togo, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, there were a series of explosions today in Burundi's capital, Bujumbura. Police report three blasts, which injured several people. The attacks come just days before scheduled peace talks in Arusha, Tanzania. Today's attacks are the latest violence that began last April when President Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term. Since then, hundreds have been killed and many thousands displaced. Reporter Moses Havayarimana is in the Burundi capital. He spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about today's incidents.
According to the police spokesman, Pierre Nkurikiye, said that at least three people were injured in these different explosions. However, he said that there were no many casualties, according to him, and he said that there is an armed group which are still carrying out some attacks in some areas, especially in the capital, and he said that they have lodged investigations in the matter and possibly to bring the perpetrators to justice.
What type of weapons were used in today's explosions?
According to the Burundi police spokesman, he said that these are grenade explosions, but however, according to some of the citizens, they are saying these are possibly rocket launches which were used to attack these areas. But according to the Burundi government, he said that these are simple grenades which were used during these attacks.
Did the police give any reason why these particular areas would be attacked?
No, for now they said the investigations have been launched, but remember that these attacks have been continuously in the Bujumbura capital, most especially, and no one has come yet out to claim these attacks, and the police and the Burundi government are saying that these are armed group and that they haven't yet been identified, and the investigations have been launched and not any identification of who are behind these attacks.
Can you tell us exactly what was attacked?
Actually, near the Bujumbura mayor's office, it was attacked, and he said that it was the two cyclists who were actually bypassing on the road, and then they threw the grenade near the mayor's office. Most of the government officials have been targeted with these attacks, most especially with the residential areas and public places. However, over the New Year's Eve and the Christmas, we have been hearing heavy gunfires in some particular areas of the capital, Burundi forces fighting the armed group. This is kind of ongoing attacks. We are ahead of the dialogue, which is set to be this week after the relaunching of the official dialogue in Kampala the last week in Entebbe.
So all the grenades were thrown at the mayor's office, is that correct?
No, these were different places of the Bujumbura suburbs. So these were just random attacks in the capital.
Reporter Moses Havayarimana is in the Burundi capital. He spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
The U.S. State Department has expressed deep disappointment that Rwandan President Paul Kagame has chosen to run for a third term in office. In his New Year message to the people of Rwanda, Mr. Kagame announced he would run again after a national referendum approved a constitutional change that lifted term limits. The changes allow Kagame to run for another seven-year term in 2017, followed by 2 5-year terms afterwards. The U.S. government has opposed a trend in African countries of presidents seeking a third term in office. A State Department spokesman says the U.S. believes constitutional transitions of power are essential for strong democracies. Rights groups acknowledge Mr. Kagame has broad support, but accuse Rwandan authorities of stifling the media and opposition voices, charges the government denies.
Over 1 million migrants and refugees arrived in Europe in 2015, mostly from Syria, Africa, and South Asia. The International Organization for Migration reports it's the biggest migration flow since World War II. Flavio Di Giacomo is an IOM spokesperson for Italy. He spoke with me about the challenges that come with complex migrant flows and how they will be dealt with in 2016.
There are two different kind of flows, actually, because in Greece you have seen the arrivals of so many people fleeing from Syria. I think that a large majority of people arriving in Greece from Turkey, which is a country of transit, is Syrian, and then there are Afghans and Iraqis and Pakistanis, but mainly Syrians and Afghans. In Greece, we are seeing a refugee crisis because these are people who are fleeing the war. So as long as the war will not end and the situation in Syria will be so difficult, of course, this flow will not end. We were expecting maybe a little bit less arrivals during winter time, but at the end of the day, we were seeing that in Greece, the authorities are registering more or less 2,000, 3,000 arrivals per day. It means that people continue to flee. And, of course, the situation in the camps in Turkey during the winter is even harsh than compared to the summer. So people are trying to join their relatives and friends in Europe. So for the moment, as long as the situation in Syria will not go any better, of course, we think that this flow will continue. But this flow may stop in the moment where the situation in Syria will get better. For Italy, the situation is a little bit different because we are seeing a mixed flow of arrivals. So there are, yes, people fleeing for wars or persecution of regimes like Eritreans, Syrians, Sudanese, Somalis. But there are also people fleeing from poverty or other kind of vulnerabilities. And those are people who are all fleeing from Libya. There are many, many migrants arriving in Italy who have been living in Libya for months or years, and they're fleeing the country because it has become a very, very dangerous country for foreigners. But not all of the people are fleeing from regimes of persecution, so the reason behind the decision of these people to leave their countries of origin will continue even in the next months or in the next years, of course. So it's going to be more difficult in that case.
And looking at the situation in Italy, what are they actually going to be doing this year differently to deal with the problem? Do you know if there's any new plan of action?
Well, the point is that all the migrants arriving in Italy, they ask for asylum. And as we know, asylum must be examined on an individual basis, not based on nationality. We have seen people arriving from Nigeria, for example. There are those who are fleeing the country because of economic reasons, but there are also people fleeing from Boko Haram. The same thing for Malians. From Mali, there are areas where there are conflicts and people are fleeing from there, and there are people who are just leaving Mali because of economic reasons. It's quite difficult for the moment to understand in Italy who's an economic migrant and who's an asylum seeker and can get entitled to some kind of protection. It takes time, of course. And all the people are, of course, they have access to the asylum procedure. And at the end of the day, the asylum commission will decide how many people will be entitled to get some kind of protection, international protection, or will be considered economic migrants. Furthermore, there are also many other vulnerabilities. There are many, many victims of trafficking. We have seen the arrivals of a lot of girls coming from Nigeria and who are victims of sexual exploitation, potential victims of trafficking. And in that case, they can get some kind of protection in Italy if, of course, they say that they have been trafficked. And there are many vulnerabilities, like unaccompanied minors or even people who are sick. So it's quite complicated. The mixed flow in Italy is very difficult to examine, and it takes time, of course, to assess every single migrant arriving in Italy. We also know there are so many migrants arriving in Italy. Italy is just a country of transit. It's the case of Eritreans and Syrians. And we know that those people are trying to leave the country in order to go to Europe. Now in Italy, we have seen the creation of these so-called hotspots, which are those places where migrants who can get entitled to some kind of protection according to the European Union, we're talking about Eritreans and Syrians, may be relocated to other European countries. This relocation procedure has started a few months ago. For the moment, numbers are quite low. Just a few hundred migrants have been relocated, but the Italian government hopes that this system of relocation will be working in the next few months in order to convince those nationalities, Eritreans and Syrians, to stay in Italy when they arrive, not to leave the country immediately, but to stay in Italy and to wait for to be relocated to other European countries.
Looking at the situation with the girls that are trafficked, what exactly is the process in helping them? Because they are dealing with not just physical situation, but emotional and mental as well.
The problem there is that we have seen a substantial increase in the number of victims of trafficking. We know that many of those girls, they arrive from the same region in Nigeria, which is the Edo State in Nigeria. They don't pay for their journey. They know that they are being trafficked, even if they do not imagine the level of exploitation, they will unfortunately be victims. And we have teams in southern Italy talking to this girl, informing them about the possibility to get some kind of protection in Italy if they say that they have been trafficked. Unfortunately, they are psychologically manipulated many times with specific voodoo ritual tribes. So many times they don't want to talk. We have managed to help many of them, but the overall majority, unfortunately, they do not admit that they have been trafficked, and they end up, unfortunately, exploited sexually.
Are the other European countries able to deal with all the various challenges of the migrants and refugees?
Well, you know, these challenges must be dealt with the first country of arrival, of course, you know, especially for the case of victims of trafficking, because after that it's going to be very complicated to find the person who arrived in order to protect them. So the protection must be provided at the moment of the arrival, because otherwise, if the migrant leave, it's going to be very difficult for the authorities to find them somewhere else.
That's International Organization for Migration spokesperson Flavio Di Giacomo. He spoke with me from Rome.
German Foreign Minister Martin Schäfer warns that the passport-free travel within the 28 member states of the European Union is in danger. That follows decisions by Sweden and Denmark to establish border controls in the EU migrant crisis. Schäfer calls freedom of movement one of the European Union's biggest achievements. Sweden has announced today that thousands of daily commuters entering from Denmark will have to show photo identification for the first time in 50 years. Travelers have been warned to expect long lines on the Danish side of the Öresund Bridge. Sweden is trying to stop the flow of undocumented migrants into the country, known for its generous welfare system. The new measures means Sweden is ending its open-door migrant policy after receiving 160,000 migrants last year. Neighboring Denmark only took in 18,000. Danish Prime Minister Lars Løkke Rasmussen said actions by other Nordic countries could lead to more asylum seekers traveling to his country. Meanwhile, German police in a city near Frankfurt say several shots have been fired at a home for asylum seekers in western Germany. One resident was slightly injured. Police say it wasn't immediately clear who is responsible for today's incident.
The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, has a new chief. Filippo Grande has begun his five-year term. He's worked for many years in refugee and political affairs in Africa, the Middle East, and Asia. Grande says the UNHCR is navigating extraordinarily difficult waters due to the migrant and refugee crisis. He replaces Antonio Guterres, who stepped down after 10 years. In a departing interview, Guterres spoke about the new and different dimension of the migrant and refugee crisis in Europe.
For the first time, refugees came in big number to the global north, to the developed world, to the rich countries. Of course, we have witnessed a dramatic acceleration of displacement in the last few years. From 2010 to 2015, the number of people displaced by conflict every day has multiplied by four, which means that we are having more and more conflicts and more people being forced to flee, and the old conflicts remain and we don't find solutions for people. 10 years ago, we were hoping 1 million people go back home every year in safety and dignity. Last year, only 124,000. So it is true that there has been a progressive aggravation of displacement and of the suffering of people because of displacement.
That's former UNHCR leader. He says when refugees settled in developing countries, there was little public outcry. Well, that changed in 2015 when they fled in large numbers to countries in Europe.
But all of a sudden, we had the refugee issues in the very center of the international debate. And the reason, unfortunately, was because the refugees came to the developed world, which means people were more concerned with the developed world than with the refugees themselves. But this also creates an opportunity. Now that the refugee questions are in the center of the international debate, we need to see how we can mobilize the international community in order to be able not only to provide adequate humanitarian aid for displaced populations, but also to support the countries hosting them, Lebanon, Jordan, but also Kenya, Cameroon, Ethiopia. And finally, to understand that people are in such a desperate situation that they will tend to move because, I mean, if they are in a host country in developing world where they cannot work, where the levels of assistance are insufficient, where the children have no access to school, they will naturally tend to move onwards.
Guterres also addressed incidents of xenophobia regarding the refugees that have occurred in some European countries.
I think it's important to take into account that obviously, there are xenophobic attitudes that we simply need to reject. But we also need to take into account that in our societies, we sometimes have people with fears, with anxieties, and we need to be able to respond to those fears and anxieties in a positive way, and not just to condemn them. One terrible thing in this so-called European refugee crisis, we know the refugees are not coming from Europe, but I mean, the problem happened in Europe. One of the things that was clear is that Europe was totally disorganized, totally divided. And because of that, Europe was not able to put its act together. And so instead of having a proper reception, proper screening, and then distribution of the refugees orderly, moving by plane from the point of entry to the different countries receiving them, what we had was a crowd of thousands of people every day moving through the Balkans in a total chaos. And when people at home in a village or a small town anywhere in Europe would see the news, they would always see this crowd coming. And the idea that started, well, they are coming, nobody's in charge, there is total lack of control. They might be coming to my house, to my community, to Europe is being invaded. This was the message that was conveyed. And this, of course, triggered some fears, some concerns.
He says the international community must address the root causes of the crisis, namely war. But he also says Europe must be better organized to receive the migrants and refugees.
To have adequate reception capacity at entry point, to have adequate security checks and screening at entry point, to be able to welcome people and to receive people when they come to Europe, and then using all European countries to distribute them in a way that would not be problematic. We are talking about, as you mentioned, 1 million people that came to Europe. That is less than 2 refugees per 1,000 Europeans. Now, in Lebanon, we have 1 refugee per each 3 Lebanese. That demonstrates that the problem would be perfectly manageable if it was managed. But unfortunately, Europe was totally divided, unable to put its act together, and so the control of the movement was not by the European authorities, but by the smugglers and the traffickers. And this is, of course, absolutely regrettable, and this helped to trigger those reactions of fear or anxiety in many European societies.
That's former UN Refugee Agency Chief Antonio Guterres, who ended his term last week.
Mm-hmm. Last month, South Sudanese President Salva Kiir appointed governors to all 28 states. That's 18 states more than South Sudan previously had. The governors all have one thing in common, they're men. Dr. Pauline Riak, the executive director of the Sud Institute, says those who are disappointed by the lack of women governors should look at the nomination process. South Sudan In Focus reporter Ayan Bior has more on the story.
During the nomination process, members of the SPLM recommend individuals to South Sudan's National Political Bureau. Riak says the Political Bureau then looks into the background of those candidates and decides who they will recommend to President Kiir, who gives the final authority. During last month's process, Riak says there was a severe lack of women in the final list of candidates that was turned over to the president.
What most people do not realize is that of the 28 states, there was only one state in which a woman was recommended out of the number of individuals. And it's a male-dominated political environment. So the only thing I can say is that we really need women to get our act together for the next election, to get our act together so that those of us who are interested in political positions can be seen.
Riak says the country's slow development has led many women to spend an overwhelming amount of time on household duties like cooking or collecting water. She says women who are interested in politics must start prioritizing their careers by participating in social issues in the country.
But we are busy working 17 hours a day doing the chores that women must do. So we have very little spare time as a nation of women to be involved with things that are not related to our household activities.
Riak says there are many capable women in South Sudan who are up to the task of governing a state. She says ultimately, women will have to stand up for themselves, identify weaknesses in political parties, and seize those opportunities.
What we need to realize is that this is politics. Nobody is giving anything for free. So as women, we have to recognize these weaknesses within the party and try to plug those gaps so that in future, the rules and regulations that go out will not be gender insensitive.
For the most part, Riak says South Sudanese women are not restricted from participating in the country's political process. She says there are no laws on the books that prevent women from voicing their opinions and participating in politics.
In South Sudan, our laws in general are very good. But in practice, because of the war, because of the poverty, we find that we, as women, we are not able to make the gains that the laws seem to want to give us. So we really have to find all ways to improve women's lot, women's participation, women's self-esteem.
Beginning next month, the state-owned Juba University will implement a national program to help educate citizens on their rights and responsibilities in their country. Riak, who serves as the Deputy Vice Chancellor of Academic Affairs at the university, says the program will target women at any stage of their political career, whether they are just beginning in politics or have been women activists for several years. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
In northern Libya, an army spokesman says Islamic State militants attacked two key oil facilities today, but the attacks were repelled. The French news agency reports the militants carried out a suicide car bomb attack on a military checkpoint at the town of Al-Sidra. Two soldiers are reported dead. Islamic State militants then reportedly launched a second on the town of Las Ranuf using a convoy of vehicles. A tank containing 420,000 barrels of oil caught fire. The AFP quotes military officials are saying the attackers were not able to enter the town. Islamic State militants are said to have been moving east in Libya from Sirte for the past several weeks trying to reach oil facilities.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiyes Ruhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
next on Reporters Roundtable. Join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable. I'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the big events in Africa in the year 2015. So please join us on Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The U.S. State Department expresses deep disappointment that Rwandan President Paul Kagame has chosen to run for a third term in office. And Filippo Grandi has begun his five-year term as the new UN Refugee Agency chief. Coming up, we'll have music from Togo. And in our feature segment, the first of a five-part series on the sexual exploitation of children in Africa. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Spuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're beginning in Zimbabwe.
Kim, the year 2015 was a tough one for Zimbabwe in sport. Most of the country's sports teams failed to make a mark on the international front, much to the dismay of passionate Zimbabwean fans. In the first of a two-part look at Zimbabwean sport in 2015, reporter Michael Cariotti chronicles the country's disastrous path and looks to the future.
From cricket to rugby via football, the year 2015 was a year that showed that Zimbabwean sport was in crisis. Team sport was a big disappointment, as not only the cricket team but other national teams also turned into punching bags of the international sporting world. However, the mighty Warriors did the nation proud by qualifying for the 2016 Olympic Games to be held in Rio de Janeiro, although that too was nothing to gloat about. The women's soccer team qualified after beating only two teams, Zambia and Cameroon, following the withdrawal of powerhouses Equatorial Guinea. This resulted in the mighty Warriors being denied the Team of the Year Award and annual National Sports Awards, with that honor going to the netball team. But still, the mighty Warriors will be there with the best the world has to offer, and Captain Felicitas Mzungoni is excited about the adventure of going to Rio.
I feel so much excited because this is our first time to qualify for the Olympics. It's our first time in history.
There were, of course, some successes in individual sports like boxing, swimming, Special Olympics, and bodybuilding. Kessie Coventry won three gold medals at the All Africa Games.
It's been an honor to represent Zimbabwe at the All Africa Games, and I was just very thankful that I was able to go there and do as well as I did. You know, I've said all along that Rio Olympics will be my last big international competition, and it was very sad. It did take me a little bit by surprise how emotional I got saying goodbye to the team. Being on the podium for the last time in Africa, it's always been such a big part of my career.
Not to be outdone was boxer Charles Manucci, who retained his World Boxing Council silver title belt after systematically knocking down Gianluca Fraser in his own home country of Italy. His Zambian handlers, Oriental Boxing Promotions, represented by Chris Malunga, immediately announced that he would be challenging British World Boxing Council bronze title belt holder Amir Khan.
Our next target is Amir Khan. I'm going to go to WBC convention in Cancun,
China,
China, to make sure that I go and bid for Charles to challenge Amir Khan. That is the route we are going for.
Sadly, though, Manucci has parted ways with Zambians, but has decided to go it alone. There were celebrations, too, for the Zimbabwe Special Olympic athletes who went to the World Games in Los Angeles. The Zimbabweans brought back 12 medals, 3 gold, 3 silver, and 6 bronze medals. Nyasha Derere was one of the athletes who brought back a gold medal.
I enjoyed the place. To me, it was like heaven on earth. Everything, the environment, everyone was cheering for us. I never knew nor dreamed that in life there are other people who are so loving, so caring. As I experienced, everyone cheering up for me, signing autographs of other people's.
The winds of change also blew in the administration and blown away by the wind when Zifa's Kadbe Dube, who was fired by the Zifa Council, and Zimbabwe cricketer Wilson Manase, who lost his post to Ngoni Mukhuhlani in an election. Dube has since been replaced by Harare businessman Philip Chiangwa, who on his part received the confidence of the same Zifa Council with a 40-vote win over Trevor Kelsey Joe, who could only manage 12 votes. Before his departure, Dube said the Zimbabwean football family was very ungrateful after financing the national team from his own pocket on a number of occasions.
Otherwise, I just told my boys, just enjoy your football. No pressure. We don't have any pressure. What for?
Chiangwa, however, has promised milk and honey for Zimbabwean football. He says he's going there to do a national service, not to waste his time.
I'm a man of action. Through my board and the Zifa Council, to make sure that the Zimbabwe flag and anthem plays at Qatar 2022.
Football, though, was characterized by tragedy following the death of three Zimbabwean greatest footballers, Willard Mashinkila Khumalo, Paul Gundani, and Freddie Nkwesha. Reporting in Harare, this is Michael Kariati.
I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. And we'll hear part two of Michael Cariotti's look at Zimbabwean sport in 2015 during Tuesday's Sunny Side of Sports. Joining us now with more sports news is Mark Ouma, the VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman. And Mark begins with handball.
Defending champions Tunisia beat hosts Switzerland 37-29 to retain their Yellow Cup handball crown in Zurich, Switzerland on Sunday. Early on Saturday, they dismissed Austria 34-29 to advance to the final. Austria outplayed Portugal 34-30 in the bronze medal playoff. Tunisia used the event as a warm-up to the Africa Men's Handball Cup of Nations starting in Egypt in a fortnight. Turning to athletics, Waknesh Edessa prevailed in the women's contest in a lifetime best of 2 hours, 24 minutes and 4 seconds at the Xiamen International Marathon in China on Saturday. Runner-up Martha Lema and Fantu Eticha completed the Ethiopian women's medal podium sweep. Meanwhile, Kenyan Vincent Kipruto clocked 2 hours, 10 minutes and 18 seconds to triumph in the men's contest. Ethiopians Shura Kitata and Feyisa Bekele placed second and third, respectively. In Spain, Kenyan-born Mike Keegan of Turkey clocked 27 minutes and 35 seconds to triumph in the end-of-the-year San Silvestre 10-kilometer road race in Madrid, Spain. Lynette Masai of Kenya was a clear winner in the women's race in 31 minutes and 38 seconds. In Italy, Ethiopians Tamirat Tola and Netsanet Gudeta were crowned winners at the both classic New Year's road race in Bolzano, northern Italy. Tola won the men's 10-kilometer contest in 28 minutes and 28 seconds, while Gudeta prevailed in the women's 5-kilometer event in 15 minutes and 57 seconds.
Thanks, Mark. That's Mark Ouma of our Daybreak Africa radio show, which you can hear Monday through Friday on The Voice of America. Turning to tennis, some of the world's top players are in Australia, where they're tuning up for the year's first Grand Slam event. The Australian Open begins January 18th at Melbourne Park. One of the players down under is Swiss star Roger Federer, whose preparations took a lighthearted turn on Sunday when he played an exhibition match using a giant racket. On a more serious note, Federer made his first trip to Malawi in 2015 in support of his charitable foundation. In this Sunny Side of Sports highlight for 2015, let's look back on Roger's trip. Swiss tennis star Roger Federer says his first visit to Malawi was an unforgettable journey and learning experience. The world's number two ranked player traveled to Southern Africa after losing to Novak Djokovic in the Wimbledon final July 12th. In Malawi, Federer visited the Mbwetu Community-Based Child Care Center, a preschool. He says his foundation has helped support the preschool for more than 4 years, as well as others in the Southern Africa region.
I'm so happy and emotional that I can see a preschool of this quality here in Malawi. I must say it's quite extraordinary, actually, and it makes me really, really happy. And that's not possible with the help of the community, the parents, ActionAid Malawi, everybody involved. It's been amazing, and it's been an absolute pleasure to be here today.
Roger Federer established his foundation in 2003 to help poor children in Africa and provide them with an education. 5 years ago, Roger played Spanish star Rafael Nadal in a charity exhibition called Match for Africa, and that Match for Africa raised more than $4 million for his foundation and Rafa's foundation. In Malawi, Roger played with the children and helped cook and serve them lunch. He says he liked what he saw at the preschool.
Really impressed at the community here because it's the driver and they are so committed to improving their own village, helping their kids for a better future and making it sustainable at the end of the day. That's most important, that this is an ongoing thing and hopefully forever.
Roger Federer has ambitious goals for his foundation and he reflects on his trip to Malawi.
I learned a lot and I thought it was an unforgettable journey of learning for me personally as well. I feel like the kids are having a great time. It's so inspiring and motivating every time I come to a beautiful country like Malawi this time. It's my first time here. And of course, I'll keep going. We have high goals for the Roger Federer Foundation to reach 1 million children that can benefit from the foundation because children are tomorrow's future.
Swiss tennis star Roger Federer speaking last year during his first visit to Malawi. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. Finally, in pro basketball, here's a Sunny Side of Sports shout out for Jimmy Butler of the Chicago Bulls. Butler broke Michael Jordan's team record for points and a half, firing in 40 of his 42 after the break to lead the Chicago Bulls to a 115-113 road victory Sunday over the Toronto Raptors. Michael Jordan had 39 points also in the second half in a game against the Milwaukee Bucks in 1988. Meanwhile, in New York City, Aaron Aflalo scored a season-high 38 points for the New York Knicks, who clipped the wings of the visiting Atlanta Hawks 111-97. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the first of our five-part series on the sexual exploitation of children as it exists in Africa. And next, rapid unplanned growth in urban areas of the developing world. But first, some music. Here is Hosti from Togo with Miyasimi.
Mama.
the peace sign and put it up and give each other a hug. Cause I don't know why we hate others. We all one blood, but different color, living in one world, sharing different nature. The same people using different culture. As a god children, we need to love each other. Stop the blood sharing, cause little ones are dying. Little ones are dying.
Hosty from Togo with Mia Simi.
Well, the sexual exploitation of children is a worldwide problem. And in the first of our five-part series on the sexual exploitation of children as it exists in Africa, VOA's Adam Phillips introduces us to the many faces of sexual exploitation, its causes, and its impact on its child victims.
According to ECPAT, a large international NGO that partners with agencies fighting the sexual exploitation of children in 83 countries. As many as 30 million African children live on the streets. Many were born in the countryside and migrated to city slums. Some fled armed conflict or natural disasters. Others became orphaned when their parents or caregivers died from HIV/AIDS or some other disease. Most of these children are and have always been extremely poor. All are at risk for sexual exploitation. Since 1999, Justa Waituka, the founder of the grassroots group Koede, has helped rescue prostituted children in Hyena Square, a hellish slum in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. She says that sex trafficking in the city often begins with labor trafficking in the village.
Because oftentimes these children are not in school. But oftentimes they have some people who are either pimps or perpetrators who find them in the villages and they bring them to the cities to work as child laborers. But at the end of the day, when they're mistreated, they end up in prostitution. So our major campaign was to dismantle those, we used to call them kiosks, talk to the authorities, link our efforts with the police, withdraw the children from that situation, take them to the shelters, undergoing rehabilitation, and then send them back home, those ones who wanted to go back home.
It's not unusual for the family of a sexually exploited girl who wants to return home to reject her out of shame. That can re-traumatize a child. Indeed, Justa Maituka admits that her work is frequently heartbreaking.
We cry with the girls, we moan with the girls, we cherish with the girls. There is a lot of pain, and physically when you see, you examine their private parts, and it's terrible.
Bringing pimps and other exploiters to the attention of law enforcement can be problematic for these prostituted children. In Africa, where the definition of a child is anyone under 18 without exception, sexual exploitation of a child is a crime. But prostitution is also illegal in most African countries, regardless of a person's age, says attorney Sheila Varadon, who runs ECPAT's legal program.
So children often get prosecuted or treated as criminals when they're actually being victimized through sexual exploitation. That's the first barrier that often is the difference between a child coming forward and a child remaining hidden. They know if they come forward, they'll be criminalized.
The rapid growth of internet access in Africa has caused a new form of sexual exploitation to spike. Children are photographed, and their pictures are uploaded to the internet against their will. The wide availability of mobile phones on the continent also puts children at greater risk, says Theo Noten of ECPAT in the Netherlands.
The landline is no longer needed. Like in the north of Ghana, where there's no water, no sanitation, but there is big antennas everywhere and young people walking around with the newest iPhone with the possibility to take pictures and also being taken on a picture. So there is a new challenge there.
The traditional practice of child marriage, often when a girl is 12 or younger, contributes to her sexual exploitation and abuse when she's forced to marry a much older man who then claims a right to have sex with her. Because child marriage in general is condoned by tribal leaders and elders in many rural areas, questioning the practice, much less putting an end to it, can be a delicate matter. Karen Staus works for Free the Slaves, a Washington, D.C.-based NGO with extensive experience in sub-Saharan Africa. She says that often cultural factors are at odds with modern legal understandings of the personhood of children, as enshrined, for example, in the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child and the African Charter on the Rights and Welfare of the Child.
There are also some places where the lack of information about health is actually exposing children to abuse at extremely young ages. There's a belief, I've heard about it the most in South Africa, but also some other Southern African countries that have had very high epidemics of HIV/AIDS, that having sex with a virgin will be a cure to disease. And so children at shockingly young ages, including babies, are being raped because people believe that this is a cure.
Sexual exploitation and abuse are usually hidden from sight, and discussing sexual subjects is still taboo in many cultures. But Staus says that can change.
We see that with relatively modest programs, you can really quickly change the social norms in a community because people in African countries are no different than anywhere else. At bottom, the majority of people want the best thing for their children, and they may have some harmful social norms that can actually change quite quickly when a community comes together, gets organized, and faces the harm that's happening to children for the children's own development and the better future of their community and their country.
With a myriad of different cultures in the world, agreeing on exact terms relating to the sexual exploitation of children has been elusive. Still, advocates for children's rights say this is a crucial goal as policymakers, NGOs, health professionals, law enforcement, and other stakeholders try to tackle the problem in an effective way. For the next part of our series, we'll look at an ambitious international project to create those guidelines. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Two-thirds of humanity will live in cities by mid-century, according to the United Nations. Rapid unplanned growth in urban areas of the developing world brings people, livestock, and wildlife together with inadequate sanitary services. As microbes evolve in this new environment, researchers look for new germs that could launch the next epidemic. VOA Steve Barragona looks at that search in Nairobi slums.
Joseph Mwai is a farmer. He raises cows, pigs, chickens, and goats, though it's not entirely by choice, he says.
It's important for me because I don't have any job to do. I make a living from there.
Mwai's farm is in the middle of Nairobi's Viwandani slum. A trash dump smolders behind his homestead, across a stream polluted with raw sewage. It's a rich environment for the spread of bacteria and other microbes.
You've got people, you've got livestock, you've got wildlife mixing together in this stew of garbage and human waste and animal waste. The opportunities for microbes to exchange genes and mix and match in new ways is tremendous.
Because microbes that pass from creature to creature pass their genes around too.
Yeah, especially the resistant genes to drugs.
John Kairu is a molecular biologist with the Kenya Medical Research Institute. He says, for example, his team found bacteria called E. coli that are resistant to 4 antibiotics. Then they found resistance spreading to other germs.
The same block of resistant genes that we had found in E. coli
were actually now in salmonella.
Even more concerning, cholera germs may have also picked up those resistance genes.
High resistance, high virulence, actually what you end up creating is a superbug.
But scientists know very little about how any bugs move through this complex environment. So a team of researchers are visiting households across Nairobi. They're swabbing people. They're swabbing livestock. They're sampling the ground with white paper booties. University of Liverpool veterinarian Judy Betteridge explains why.
To try and understand on a small scale, I mean, even within just sort of 20 meters, how are those bacteria shared? And then when we scale it up, are the bacteria here being shared with the household that's 50 meters over there or 100 meters over there? So how far can they actually spread?
And can they spread further through food, for example? Once they find out, Kairu says, they need to be careful not to point fingers.
We are not necessarily investigating who is spreading the resistant or the virulent organisms, but actually we are trying to solve a problem.
The problem to solve? The conditions that spread new germs through the slums of Nairobi and beyond. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Nairobi.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer Nashwan Kali, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States on December 19th expressed disappointment in the process followed by the government of Rwanda to call a referendum on short notice to amend the Rwandan constitution. Among the amendments considered were those introducing exceptions to presidential term limits. In a statement released December 19th, National Security Council spokesperson Ned Price said, "While we commend the people of Rwanda for peacefully exercising their civic rights, we regret that the arrangements for the referendum failed to provide sufficient time and opportunity for political debate on the merits of the proposed provisions." The United States continues to be concerned by long-standing restrictions on peaceful assembly, association, and free expression in Rwanda. The U.S. urges the government of Rwanda to enable the full and unfettered exercise of these fundamental freedoms as the country moves toward local elections in 2016, presidential elections in 2017, and parliamentary elections in 2018. The peaceful transfer of power from one leader to another is the hallmark of stable, prosperous democracies. President Kagame, who in many ways has strengthened and developed Rwanda, now has an historic opportunity to enshrine his legacy by honoring his commitments to respect the term limits set when he entered office. By doing so, President Kagame would help to more firmly establish a credible foundation for long-term democracy in Rwanda, reinforce the substantial progress that has been achieved towards sustained peace and prosperity for all Rwandans, and set a laudable example not only for Rwanda, but for the region and the world. As U.S. President Obama has stated, great leaders throughout history forged a lasting legacy not only because of what they did in office, but because they were willing to leave office and transfer power peacefully. The United States remains committed to supporting the people of Rwanda in their effort to ensure a strong, stable, democratic, and prosperous future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.
VOA News.
VOA. When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.